Of course, I would not. I would be very remiss in not also welcoming Karen and Christine and Krista to the who are right next to Akram and Cyrus. Welcome as well. Sorry. So the list of topics we have discussed and forwarded to you four main topics. One of which is any other business, which is of course the open floor with any questions and complaints that the councillors might raise to the GDD division staff. So the first topic of the day is the status update on the GNSO implementation related projects. Could you give us an update of where the current status of these is?
Just one second. So good morning, everyone. I'm Cyrus Namazi with Global Domains Division of ICANN, and according to Folker, everybody knows me. Just wanted to suggest maybe a reshuffling of some of the items and perhaps suggest that we provide the status update on UGTLD program review and the implementation-related projects. Then the item number two is a discussion, and we can jump into that and follow that up with any other business.
That would be fine, yes, sure. However you would like to structure it.
Thank you. So, go Caitlin, ahead. I think she's going to provide the implementation-related updates.
This is Caitlin Tubergen from GDD. There are some slides that accompany my update. Okay. The first item is UDRP locking. The updated UDRP rules were announced in November 2014. Next slide. Thank you. All ICANN-accredited registrars and UDRP providers will be required to comply with the updated UDRP rules by July 31st, 2015. Next is the additional Who Is Information policy, which is IRTPB Recommendation 8 and IRTPC Recommendation 3. These recommendations have been incorporated into the additional Who Is Information policy, which is binding on all registries and registrars starting on January 31st, 2016, although many registries and registrars appear to have voluntarily begun complying early. Next slide, please. IRTPC recommendations 1 and 2, which is the change of registrant policy and time limiting of FOAs. These recommendations were incorporated into the transfer policy, which went out for public comment on March 30th of this year. Public comment closed May 16th. The implementation review team is currently discussing all comments received, and we anticipate this process could be concluded a few weeks after the Buenos Aires ICANN meeting. For THIC Who Is, for the first outcome of recommendation 1, which is transition from thin to THIC, the IRT will be meeting during ICANN 53 to discuss the findings of the legal review and start working out implementation details. That session will be held Wednesday, June 24th at 5 o'clock p.m. in Retiro B. For the second outcome of Recommendation 1, which is the consistent labeling and display for all GTLD registries, ICANN staff will discuss implementation proposals and open issues with the IRT in connection with work which has started on the rollout of RDAP and future replacement of the WHOIS protocol. Update on Recommendation 3, which is the legal review. On June 8th, ICANN staff delivered to the IRT a memorandum for consideration in relation to Recommendation 3 on a review of law applicable to the transition of data from a thin to thick WHOIS model. For further details on this, please attend the session on Wednesday. Next slide, please. For IGO-INGO, a call for IRT volunteers will be sent to the PDP mailing list and contracted parties stakeholder groups after the ICANN 53 meeting. Work with the IRT is expected to start within a few weeks of the call for volunteers. Next is IRTPD. A call for IRT volunteers was sent to the PDP mailing list a few weeks before the ICANN 53 meeting. Work with the IRT will commence a few weeks after this meeting. And lastly, the privacy proxy services accreditation issues. GDD staff continues to monitor the efforts of the working group and has provided implementation notes to the policy team to share with the working group as it considers the other comments received on the initial report.
Thank you, Caitlin, for your presentation. We see that there's quite a lot of projects that we've kicked off that are moving ahead quite nicely. Are there any questions on the floor with regard to the current projects and their status that might have been left open? Seeing none, I would like to yield to Cyrus for a comment.
Thank you, Volker. I just wanted to mention that we've actually posted a policy implementation calendar that has all of this information in it, and we maintain it routinely with new information that comes in, so you can have up-to-date info about the status of the different projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Cyrus. As we've moved the schedule around a little bit, I think next is the update on the new GTLD program activities. Who's going to make that, Karen? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Volker. Thank you, Council. I'm Karen Lentz from the Global Domains Division, and I was asked to speak about the, to give an update on the new GTLD program review activities. So I'll focus on the highlights since we last met in Singapore. There's a session tomorrow which will go through the work that's been done in greater detail, but I'll try to hit on the highlights here. So on this slide, I think as most of you know, a lot of the review activities are focused around the provision in the affirmation of commitments for a review of the impact of the new GTLD program on competition, consumer trust, and consumer choice, which we'll call CCT here. The AOC provides that that review team will look at three things, the first being competition, consumer choice, consumer trust. And that's the first bar that you see there. And with that, there has been, for some time, an effort underway where the GNSO and ALAC recommended some metrics that could be collected and analyzed to help inform that review. That led into an implementation advisory group, which made some recommendations on specific metrics to help inform that, including a consumer survey and an economic study, which are both two-phase projects. The next part in the AOC that that team is asked to look at is the effectiveness of the application and evaluation process. So we're calling that the program implementation reviews, and that is also underway where the staff is looking at the various elements of the program and with how they were operated in terms of efficiency, effectiveness, consistency, and a number of things like that. The third area that the team is asked to look at is the safeguards that were put in place to mitigate some issues potential issues that could arise from the expansion of the namespace. And so we also have a number of review activities around the rights protection mechanisms in particular. You'll also see on the bottom, in parallel, we are kicking off in the area of security and stability, a study on the impact of the program on the root zone system, which will look at the technical elements and impact of having a lot more TLDs within the root system. Next slide. So here is kind of where we are on all of these items. Under the CCT metrics area, we completed phase one of the consumer survey. That was published at the end of May, and we'll go through that in greater detail tomorrow. It asks questions about consumer perceptions, awareness of TLDs, their experiences with abuses such as malware, phishing, etc. We also have kicked off the economic study in March. And we've been in the phase of data collection and analysis. We've collected quite a bit of data from contracted parties, as well as looking at a lot of data on pricing and other factors that's publicly available. So our target for that report is August, but we will have an update in tomorrow's session on the findings to some of the findings to date. Finally, on the rest of the metrics, which cover things like number of IDN registrations, some analysis of UDRP decisions, geographic distribution of registrants, a number of those things that we have data collected for, and those will be housed on a dashboard, which is very close to being ready. So we have expect to have that available in July. Moving to the program implementation aspect, this is also in progress. Our expectation for that is that the report will be able to be posted for public comment in September. That is a staff kind of self-assessment of the operational aspects of the program. It essentially goes through the phases in a similar way to the applicant guidebook, and that it focuses on, for example, evaluation, objection processes, and looks at each of those areas to determine what we can gain from that experience. And I actually want to mention that I should have maybe titled this slide something else, because though many of these activities are focused around the CCT review and will be inputs to that, they also serve some other purposes, which I'll talk about. But in terms of the program implementation review, one of the things we expect to get from that, in addition to the input to the CCT team, is that we've documented the staff experience in implementing the program, and when it gets to the point where we're developing a new application process or an improved application process, that will be a point of reference. So it looks at things like very sort of big picture issues about dealing with evolving discussions in the community, and as well as sort of details like applicants having difficulty with banking charges when paying fees. So you can look forward to that report in September. The last point there on rights protection mechanisms. So we have completed a public comment period on the draft report that was published. We did complete the summary and analysis of public comment that's posted, and we're currently updating the paper based on that comment. The RPM review we also think will serve a couple of purposes in addition to supporting the CCT team. One being it's a little bit of a precursor to the independent review of the Trademark Clearinghouse, which we've committed to do and which the GAC had requested. It will also, we think, be an input to the issue report that the GNSO has a request for in October, I believe, which is looking at all RPMs, not just the new ones. So it includes the UDRP in addition to the new RPMs that are covered in this report. Next slide. So this is the session we have tomorrow. I forgot to mention on the previous slide, we've also been following the work of the GNSO discussion group, and understand there's some consideration of next steps here at this meeting, so we're very interested in that. And the new GTLD program review session is tomorrow afternoon. It's a two-hour session, and even that, I think, will be hard to pack in all the information that we have, because there's a lot going on, so I hope that you can join us there. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. I think we have a very good overview of the progress on the review channels and the review progress that the first round of new GTLDs had baked in into the program. And there's a timeline which is very speedily, I would comment on, that is until I think September the first reports will be out. So that's a good sign. I think we will look forward to seeing those reports, and interpreting them. You rightly say that we have a motion on the table for this week, which is to request an issue report. This will, of course, the work that comes out of that will also work with the reports that we receive and the AOC reviews that also take place at the same time, although the timing is still at issue here. So this is something that is very important for this work as well, and we're looking forward to seeing the results of that. I think by the end, by the time of the next meeting, we should already have the first reports in hand, right? Are there any questions for this? Brett?
Thank you, Karen. That was very helpful. What is your best estimate right now as to when we might open a subsequent round for new applications, if you could ballpark it within a year?
Thanks, Brett. So it's you know, it's very difficult to speculate. I think that some of the some of the previous commitments to reviews sort of carried the expectation that they would be a prerequisite to having a future round. For example, in particular, the study on the route, you know, the impact on the stability of the route. So I think that is you know, probably an 18-month process. I'm, you know, estimating at the long end, by the time you, you know, do the study, have public comment, have whatever discussions you need to have on it. So that, I think, would put us probably around the end of 2017, which would be the probably earliest possible time frame.
Can I ask a quick follow-up? Has ICANN, and maybe if it hasn't, maybe we should, create a project management plan that works toward that goal and puts those things in the critical path, including the work that we're going to do as the GNSO and puts it on a chart so we can have some. You know, I know that timelines move in the ICANN process all the time, but at least we can start to, you know, put things down on a board and watch them.
Thanks, Brett. Yes, I think we can. I think that's something that we're in the process of building, you know, because we do, you know, have these review activities planned and scheduled. We also know that there are, you know, other efforts going on in the community, which we want to coordinate with those processes. And so I think we're still sort of getting a handle on, you know, what groups are working on what and what their sort of timeframes and processes are. And so, you know, we have sort of a partial schedule, if you want to call it that, for the things we know about. But I think, you know, for example, if there is a PDP initiated and we understand the scope of work, that will help to build, you know, sort of coordinate the topics and so forth.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you, Brett. Jeff, please go ahead.
That's way too high.
Who is that tall? I mean, seriously. Except for Volker and Krista. I guess my question is a pretty simple question. Are any of the staff reviews dependent on the AOC review, or are you guys waiting for the outcome of the AOC review to conduct your own reviews?
Thanks, Jeff. So, no, I think we think about it a little bit the other way around, in that the staff work is, you know, meant to help inform the community discussions that occur. So we're not waiting for that.
Thanks. I just raised it because that was a issue that was discussed yesterday with the GNSO as to whether we should wait for the AOC reviews or whether we should conduct our reviews before the AOC review is complete. And I think that helps. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Any further questions on this topic? Then I would like to move to the last drafted, formulated topic that we have on the agenda before we have the any other questions. The perspective on the role of bilateral contract negotiations versus policy development. This was a topic that was debated yesterday on this floor as well, that there has been a certain concern that staff has or is from time to time pushing through topics that would be subject normally to a policy development process, such as the introduction of the URS for legacy TLDs, such as the requirement of having signed the 2013 RAA in the registry agreements to get accredited for the new GTLDs. These are all topics that would normally be subject to a mandate from the GNSO, but staff has undertaken to introduce them without such a mandate, and we would like to see your perspectives on that.
Thank you, Volker. So thank you for having us here, first of all, and thank you for coming to this meeting. I would start by saying that we understand that the new GTLD program is a progression to the previous GTLDs that we've launched and that the community came up with a more robust and better ways of doing some RPMs in the new GTLD program. And we start from the position that basically these were already policies that were developed by the community, and they were put in the new GTLD program when legacy TLDs came to renew their contract, and they've asked to actually be on the new contract. We did not push anybody to accept URS or not accept URS. Actually, it came in, and you know, we put the new contract for them. They negotiated some terms, and we accepted it. Now, of course, absolutely, if the community comes up with a new policy, then we will automatically abide by it, and the contracts will be abiding by it. So if the GNSO comes up with a policy deciding that the URS should not apply to the legacy TLDs, that will be de facto accepted. So so I think it's pretty much just operational and not actually something that we're pushing for on this instance on the URS, or that we forced legacy TLDs to accept these terms in order for them to get on the new contract even. So I hope that clarifies it a little bit more.
Seeing the first hand, I would like to yield to James for the first question.
Hi, thanks. Thanks, Akram, Cyrus. Good to see you guys. A couple of questions on this point. So you're saying that this was a voluntary adoption or a negotiation by those registries. They agreed to take on the URS and I think there was the PICS as well, was another element of the new GTLD program that they moved into their agreements. Okay. Because I was part of the group that came up with URS back in, help me, 2009, 2010. And I think at that time we were very clear that it would not apply to legacy TLDs in the absence of a PDP. So I was a little surprised. I don't have a problem with the URS either. You know, as registrars or personally, I think we have a procedural problem because now we have this thing sort of percolating into other agreements where it was never intended to go. At the same time, we have different interests that are asking to change the URS. So there's a concern that not only is it now being unevenly applied to different TLDs at different times, but we could actually end up with multiple versions or variants of the URS in the way that it's being implemented or defined within the contract. So that's a concern. When something bypasses the GNSO, it kind of becomes a free-for-all, and it becomes sort of a back-of-the-napkin policy instead of something formal that we can all look at and agree upon. So this is, I'm not speaking for registrars or for the council, I'm just speaking for myself here, is that to get everybody on the same page, it's important that these things follow the prescriptive policy development process so that we're all working from the same sheet of music.
Thank you, James. I think the same applies also to the introduction of the 2013 RAA in the registry agreement, which was never a part of the new GTLD program as it was envisioned by the community. The new registrar agreement at that time was still very much in fetal stage, so to say. So nobody at that time had any thoughts of incorporating that or making that mandatory. So that was clearly a staff-led initiative as well. Michele?
Yeah, thanks, Volker. Michele Nolan for the record. Just following on from James's comments, I mean, the concern, I think, with some of this is around the fact that if you look at where the new TLD contract came from, I mean, it's a contract and it's a series of processes and steps and RPMs and a whole bunch of other things which are designed to start something new, to launch from zero, with zero domain names, zero businesses affected, zero registrants. Whereas pushing something like that, a lot of the elements within that contract onto an existing TLD, which could have anything from a couple of hundred to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of domain names and existing businesses, it's a bit of a disjoint. Now, to say that registries are coming along and kind of begging to take on a whole load of extra work does sound a little strange to me. And I mean, I've heard from several sources that they haven't exactly been begging to adopt these things, but okay. The concern that James has raised and others of us have been discussing is that there are elements within that contract that weren't really subject to policy. And now with this change of contract coming through, that you are opening up a kind of an issue there. So, for example, around URS, as it wasn't subject to a PDP, it could be changed at the moment without going through that, and then you're adding it into a contract which is affecting existing registrants. I mean, it's a matter of concern, so I'm not sure exactly where we're going to go with this, but I think it's something that needs to be discussed. Thanks.
Thank you, Michele. Next in queue is Thomas and then Phil.
Yes, this is Thomas Rickert for the record. I'd just like to say that nothing keeps a registry away from using URS or UDRP, even if they're not obliged to. There are examples out there in the market where players do that on a voluntary basis. So they can go out and advertise to their customers that they're using these mechanisms. I think it creates an unfortunate precedent, to say the least, if I can, by contract, potentially erodes the enormous policy efforts that are happening in the community to help legacy TLDs or to find ways for legacy TLDs to adopt new standards. I think IGO, INGO protection is one of these examples. So if we create precedents, there's an expectation potentially in the market that, you know, we don't need to do transition planning for legacy TLDs because we can all do that by voluntary or pressured agreements, whatever the angle might be. But I guess that the perception from the wider community is not ideal.
Thank you, Thomas. And I would like to state that if you want to jump in and respond at any time, please feel free. I'm not trying to follow the queue and leave you out of that. So anytime you want to say anything, please go ahead.
So, I mean, I don't want to sound we don't care about this, but if the GNSO would like to give us guidance on these things, you know, please give us some guidance on how you would like us to do this. But my understanding is that every registry negotiates its contract independently, and as long as we comply with the policies that exist, that a registry could ask for additional services in their contract, could do different things in their contract. If the GNSO would like to decide on every contract negotiation, okay, let's go figure out how we can do that. But I think that we have a role here, and our role is to make sure that new contracts are compliant with the GNSO policies and allow businesses to do what they need to do to be able to carry their business and move forward on the registry side. If there is something that the GNSO feels like needs to be addressed, I think that we should pretty much address it clearly and make sure that there is a policy on that so that we can comply with that. I'm struggling a little bit with the issue because I'm not seeing it coming from the registries who negotiated their contracts with us. I think that some of them felt that they wanted to be competitive in the marketplace, and the new marketplace is the new GTLD, and they didn't want to be felt to be left behind. Some of them voluntarily accepted these terms and said, yes, we want to step up to the new GTLD contract obligations, and they made these commitments publicly. And so now we're being blamed for working with you guys to give you what you want. And, okay, so how do we win here? I'm struggling with that, but I'm listening, and if you guys want to give us advice on this, we would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Akram. I just pass on to the next in the queue, Phil.
Thank you. Phil Corwin from the business constituency. The business constituency will be filing a comment letter today noting that the constituency would probably, through a PDP, support the URS becoming a consensus policy, and the BC also might support changes in the URS once the staff issues report is received this fall. Policy staff asked for a six-month delay, but we don't have the benefit of that report. However, the notice for .travel and the .cat and .pro notices are identical, says, with a view to increase the consistency of registry agreements across the TLDs, ICANN has proposed that the renewed agreement contain the PDTRP and the URS. So it looks like it came from ICANN, and when it shows up in travel and then PRO and CAD, it looks like a consensus policy. It quacks like a consensus policy. It looks like something that ICANN is enforcing, and there's been no PDP, and this is significant because if you connect the dots, these are rather small TLDs, but it would, you know, there are some big ones coming up for renewal in the next few years with over 100 million total registrants, and it's something that just properly should be done. It is a major policy. I would just finally, I want to echo what James said personally. While I wasn't an official member of the IRT, the STIRT, I was very much involved as the RPMs for the new TLD were created, and asked several times, if we accept these for the new TLDs, does that mean they will be imposed on the incumbent TLDs when they come for renewal? And was assured by participants in those groups and by staff in charge of the program, no, these are just implementation details. They cannot be imposed on legacy TLDs without a PDP and become a consensus policy. So there's a little bit of a bait and switch feeling here about those of us who participated in good faith in the development of the RPMs. It's not to say there's anything wrong or that they can't be improved, but just before there's imposed on legacy TLDs, which have far more registrants than the new ones, there should be the proper process to consider all the potential issues and then make a decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Do you want to come back on that? Or
should well, I... the only thing I would say is that I'm struggling with the idea of that we, a registry, cannot do anything unless there is a PDP on it. I think that, the fine issue here is if a registry wants to do something and we don't see a harm, and or if we think that it would be good to do something and the registry sees no issue with that, now we cannot do it unless there is a PDP. And that's the nuance that I'm not getting. Now, if there is a PDP on something and the registry doesn't want to do it or we want to do the opposite to that, I agree with you 100%. That's not acceptable. So So the nuance that we're paralyzed unless a PDP is in there, even though we both agree that we want to do something, ICANN, which represents the community in the negotiating of the contract, and the Rashti, who's willing to do something, if we both agree that that's a good thing to do, we want to do it, now we can't do it. That's the only thing that I'm not very clear on, if that's where we want to get to or not. But
thank you, Akram. Just before I move back to the queue, which is Heather, Jeff, David, James, and Greg, just a brief comment. I think any registry can, without part of the contract, implement a new policy for itself and say, for example, we want to have the URS, even though we're not up for renewal, we want to have that as a policy because we like it. Having this baked into the contract renewal leaves a bad aftertaste with some people who might get the impression that this is something forced upon the registry by ICANN staff in order to get a smooth renewal. Cyrus?
Thank you, Volker. I think hearing everyone making the comments that they've made, and I thank you for that, leads me to believe that there's a disconnect here between what we've done and what the perception is by some council members perhaps, and some in the community. There's been no imposition of URS, as Phil mentions, or as Michele mentions, there's been no one begging for it. This is just the types of thing that occurs in the course of negotiations. We've indicated to the legacy TLDs whose contract has been up for negotiation that we have a preference for them to move to the new form. But there has been no enforcement of the inclusion of URS. It's just been something that we've suggested and they've taken up. We post these for the public to see, to be able to comment on. But by no means have we crossed the line to say you must sign up for URS. And I think this perhaps is where the disconnect is. We have not done such a thing. I think it's important to note that.
Thank you, Cyrus. I'll just move down the queue, which is now Heather. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Volker. Heather Forrest. I want to make it very clear that the views that you've heard from some of the councillors this morning are not universally shared within the GNSO. The IPC has submitted a comment on this, and it's a good opportunity to highlight some key points there, in particular that we're not dealing with consensus policy in relation to legacy TLDs, and there's no requirement that in order to adopt something in its contractual relationship with ICANN, that something has to be consensus policy for these GTLDs, these legacy GTLDs. And we're at risk here of interfering. If the situation is, as you say, that there hasn't been any strong-arming here, then we're interfering with a contractual relationship and a voluntary uptake of responsibilities, and we wouldn't want to interfere with that process. Thank you.
Quite right, Heather. Next is Jeff.
Yeah, thanks. This is Jeff Newman. I actually want to side here with ICANN on this one. If a registry wants to voluntarily agree, it's a first. Come on. Tweet it. If a registry wants to voluntarily agree to adopt rights protection mechanisms that are above and beyond what's required, they should have every right to do so. Donuts did so with the Donuts Protected Marks List. Right Side did it as well with, they use the same acronym, but I forgot what it stands for, probably Domains Protected Marks List. And others have adopted PICs and other things that protect rights protection mechanisms. .us adopted the URS voluntarily for their country code top-level domain. And I understand the concern is, especially from Phil, you've done a number of articles on this and have gotten a lot of signatories to it. If your concern is about .com and .net, then go to VeriSign. Tell VeriSign not to adopt it. They're in this room. They're all around. If you don't want them to adopt it, tell them not to voluntarily adopt it. And like ICANN said, they can't force anyone to adopt it. If any of the registries, Travel, CAT, and I'm forgetting the third, Pro, is it Pro? if they come forward and they say, yes, we were forced by ICANN to do it, we don't want to do it at all, then that's one thing. Then we can have evidence that it's imposed. But until that comes, then we have to assume that it was voluntary, and any registry that wants to voluntarily adopt rights protection mechanisms must have the ability to do so at their discretion, unless the GNSO Council, through the GNSO community, comes up and decides a different policy. To do otherwise, as Heather said, is to interfere with the contractual relationship and to basically do away with the registry's right to actually go above and beyond. So I actually have to side with ICANN and say that registries should have that right to do that.
Thank you, Jeff.
I never thought I would live to see a day like this, actually, just so you know for the record.
Yeah, I think the day is saved for you guys, right? Next in the queue is David, then I have an online question, then James, Greg, and Marilyn.
okay, well, I'm going to disagree with Jeff there, actually. I think there is a real issue here between voluntary adoption and ICANN enshrining that in contract. I mean, to thank Jeff for mentioning the GPML, which the Globally Protected Marks List idea, because that's an excellent example where a policy that was explicitly rejected by the ICANN consensus policy process suddenly, via the PICS mechanism, got incorporated into, you know, contracts, and now ICANN is expected to enforce somehow a policy that it actually explicitly rejected as community policy. Similarly, if we had a PDP and we said, no, we do not think the URS should be adopted, in any way enforced on legacy TLDs, well, that's fine. If the legacy TLD wants to adopt it, but then ICANN putting into contractual arrangement something that I'm not saying that's happened, but we could end up in that process. When ICANN jumps in and puts into contractual arrangements things that we have not determined through a policy process, it is assuming the outcome of that policy process in some way. If they want to respect the URS, fine. But ICANN saying, and you should put that in a contract, unilaterally, without any policy asking them to do so, is a different case. So, I mean, if Dot Travel wants to have the URS, fine. If ICANN says you should put that in your contract, that's not fine. It is ICANN presuming the outcome of a policy process. And ICANN should not it should not put itself in the position where it'll end up enforcing something that not only is not part of a policy process, but may end up being a counter to it if we have one that explicitly says we should not do this. I mean, I think we're all agreed that, hey, actually, a policy process to decide whether applying the URS to legacy TLDs might be a good idea. But if ICANN's put it in the contract, it's presumed the outcome of that policy process. What if we decide it's a bad idea and you find yourself in the position of contractually enforcing something that the consensus policy process has said you shouldn't?
If the consensus policy says that we should not enforce the URS, then it becomes policy and it becomes contractual obligation automatically. So all what the GNSO has to do is to actually make a policy, and then it becomes de facto contractual obligation for everybody.
I'm just saying the timing of those. Perhaps we make the policy, then you decide what goes into the contract, rather than the other way around.
I think this is a good summary of what many have expressed yesterday, although this is not universally shared, of course. Next question is from online, Maxima Zoba. Does it mean that the Ibero system is also implemented for these TLDs, or is this not part of the negotiations? So
I think it depends. I don't think that the Ibero was for 5 years from the new GTLD inception, so it probably doesn't apply. I think we took it out. Is that correct? But every contract is separate, and there are red lines between the old and the new, and the so you can see what every contract has in it. So for example, I can tell you, like, there's no sunrise requirements for legacy TLDs, although they are in the new GTLDs. So, I mean, these are things that we do, that you do case by case. So,
Thank you, Akram. I hope this answers the question. Next in queue is James, followed by Greg, and then Marilyn.
Thanks. James here. I actually want to agree with Jeff Newman a little bit, except for the part where he backs up ICANN, because, you know, I have to keep with my reputation. But no, generally I agree that, you know, the PDP is not the only exclusive path to adopting changes in either a registry agreement or registrars, for that matter. But I think that this particular incident, and maybe my concern is a little different and maybe a little nuanced, but I'm concerned that the problem I have with registries adopting things like DPML and other things is that as the number of registries proliferates, the number of various implementations and flavors of implementations proliferates, and that if we were to, as a council, say, we like the URS, we want to improve it, enhance it, change it, or whatever, now we have to wait for these three registries to come up for renewal again, perhaps, or explicitly make a modification that the new URS replaces the one that's in their existing contracts. You see, it gets complicated when there are multiple versions of things out into the wild, and that's one of my concerns when we do this route, this piecemeal route, rather than going through a blanket PDP. But I just, again, you know, if we can get, we're all talking around the folks that are asking, apparently volunteering to have this in their agreement, if we can get them to say, yeah, this is fine by us, then this is a non-issue, except for the version control issue that I'm raising. The second part is, are there other elements of the new GTLD program that you would like to see incorporated in legacy TLDs at renewal? And if so, what do you think those might be?
I don't think that there are that we're picking and choosing things. I think that for us, we believe that the new again, I think from our perspective, is getting to the new form is a operational thing that makes things a lot easier, because if we can have one form agreement, at least one base form agreement that we can apply for all of the registries, given that we have going to have over 1,000 GTLDs, will actually benefit us operationally. We're not saying, oh, you need to have this one, it's okay. I mean, we're not picking and choosing these items other than the ones that are like basically obvious, that a legacy TLD will not have a sunrise obligation since they've been in operation for a very long time. Ibero is a 5-year thing, so probably doesn't apply. You know, these kind of clean things that are only for a period of time when you introduce a new GTLD. Other than that, we're not, you know, we would like everybody to be on the same contract as new GTLDs because it's operationally easier. Now, if the registry says to us, well, I can't do it, my situation is this way, we're not saying, no, you don't get your contract renewed unless you do this. I mean, that's not what's going on. So I hope this is... I think we're making a bigger issue out of this, but we're willing to listen. And I think your reversion issue is a very important issue. We don't want to make it harder on the other partners on the registrar side to implement things by having all of these different versions of things. But the URS in itself is not a version issue, because it's a URS and you either implement it or you don't. When there is improvements to the URS, I think it'll go across the board. So I hope that it's...
But if it goes through PDP...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's possible that someone could negotiate a better URS, a different URS.
Well, they could also do it without negotiating it.
Right.
But okay, you know, so...
Well, that's what we're trying to prevent.
Yeah.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Akram. Seeing that we're moving up to the top of our hour, I just have to ask that if you have a little more time that we could use so we can work through the queue, because Theresa and Jonathan are both also running late. Is that okay? Okay, then next in queue, there's Greg.
Thank you. Greg Shatton, president of the Intellectual Property Constituency, for the record. You know, listening to this... Here are a few odd things. First, seem to be. I'd like to remind everyone that the U in URS stands for uniform. So the idea of a better URS or a different URS is an oxymoron. The idea is that it's uniform. If there's somebody is going to get into some other thing, it's not going to be the URS. It's going to be another system. So I think the idea of having it in the contract is to keep it uniform. I think it's also rather an odd idea that you could adopt it at any time except when you're in a contractual negotiation with ICANN. I don't see the distinction between the two, and indeed if you are signing on to the uniform or rapid suspension system, even if you were to do it voluntarily, seems like that would probably be something that might be subject to a contractual amendment rather than something that, like the DPML, that is just dealt with as an internal policy. So, again, the idea that it can't be dealt with in contract seems to me to be peculiar. Last, if we're concerned about optics, the optics of certain registries attempting to discipline unruly members of their industry has terrible optics from a competition perspective. And at the bottom, URS can be seen as a competitive aspect. Clearly for .travel, which has not exactly swamped overtaken .com in popularity, the idea of something that's seen by consumers as being a competitive advantage and putting them more kind of on market in terms of their terms, which is something that competitors often try to do. Being off market is not generally seen to be good unless it's seen to be better for your intended consumers than those who are offering things. So this is, it seems to me like this is a good, clean competition, good, clean contractual negotiation, and that while there may be some who are standing on principle, there may be others who don't like the URS and are using this as a way to try to keep it ring-fenced. And lastly, consensus policy is something that, once it's defined, is unilaterally it's developed by the community and approved, but after that it becomes de facto unilaterally imposed in contract. Agreeing to things on a contract-by-contract basis isn't in conflict with the concept of consensus policy. So from my point of view, I agree with Jeff, and our comment submitted supports the actions here. It's clearly, and it's our understanding, that this is a result of free negotiations, which, again, we support. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Just been informed that Theresa Swinehart has arrived, so I would hate to cut this discussion short, but I would say that we draw a line under the current queue, and after that, just ask if you have any other business for that you would like to mention to us. Next in queue is Marilyn, then Avery, Heather, Phil, and Stephanie, and that's it. Please go ahead, Marilyn.
Thank you. My name is Marilyn Cade. I'm going to make three quick comments. One is I think it's really important to remember what a wonderful model that we have all created in a form of self-governance and the use of contracts as opposed to relying on national laws and regulations that have to be modified on a country-by-country basis. So that's point number one. Point number two is I do think it's important to remember that uniform does have a requirement that there be a certain amount of uniformity and predictability, and in moving to an environment where there are over 1,000 GTLDs, predictability and understandability is important to the registrants as well, not just to the suppliers. Registrars and registries will have the burden of dealing with too much diversity in the contract, but so do the registrants. And I just want to reinforce that point. So whatever we do, I hope we're going to remember that if you have to register or feel you have to register in multiple GTLDs and CCTLDs, and you have a huge diversity of contracts in each of them, you inside your company have to also put a compliance mechanism in place to make sure that your team who is registering names are adhering to the diversity. So there's a baseline of interest here on the part of the registrants as users as well. My final point I'm going to make is something about the use of standard operating practices, that you know, in another part of the world that I live in, we develop technical standards. And I think perhaps we need to be thinking about thinking that the policies that we're developing also have to have a certain amount of standardization to them if they're going to continue to scale.
Thank you, Marilyn. I think you raised some interesting points there. Next in queue is Avri.
Thank you. Avri Doria speaking. I, too, actually support the notion of purely voluntary RPMs. In fact, the original policy that the new GTLD program that we're all in came up with was indeed that it would be just purely voluntary RPMs. Somehow or other that eroded. I'm not sure I remember which PDP ever decided that there would be mandatory RPMs of any sort, either for new or old GTLDs, but perhaps somebody can tell me which PDP that was established in. But we have basically eroded over time this whole notion of purely voluntary RPMs. So you asked if GDD should be paralyzed if they wish to institute a policy that has not been through a PDP. And I would say most definitely yes. The answer to that is pretty much an unequivocal yes. Now, we've sort of entered a gray area here where you're saying that, well, now these incumbents are instituting these things voluntarily. But when there are incentives of various sorts for or fee reductions or what have you, for these voluntary impositions of RPMs, one can ask, is that an incentive or is that just an offer that can't be refused?
Thank you, Avery. I think Heather is next in the queue.
Thank you very much. Heather Forrest, I just wanted to pick up on the comments that David made indicating that the community rejected various RPMs, so that somehow prevents their voluntary adoption. Question 29, I went back and looked at the language just to be absolutely certain so that I don't say something stupid here. Always allowed applicants to declare their RPMs. It was never a tick box exercise. It was never a how do you go about implementing the consensus policy RPMs. Question 29, a complete answer should include, at a minimum, the registry operator must offer a sunrise period on a trademark claim service. At a minimum. I mean, that language is useless if it doesn't mean you can go ahead and do other things. I realize we're talking about legacy TLDs, but I wanted to make that point quite clear. Thank you.
And just to clarify, I have no problem with the GPML idea of voluntary adoption. It's only ICANN finding itself enforcing something it's actually rejected as policy. Next was Phil, I think.
Thank you. Speaking for myself now, just listening to this, I think just this council, well, two things. One, I don't disagree with the notion that a registry can propose things that are not consensus policy to be in their contract. I have to think, I don't know, I can't think of a clear example now, that there might be instances where a registry would propose a provision that ICANN would say, no, that's against the public interest or there's something wrong with that. So I there have to be some parameters on that, just as a general principle. But I think for this council, we're going to have to consider now, I don't know what's going to happen with these contracts. The comment period on travel closes today on CAT and PRO later in the month. But now that URS is at both new TLDs and legacy TLDs, and the way the specific contract provision is written, any change in the URS would apply to those legacy TLDs as well as the new ones. This council is going to have to consider the question of, after we receive the staff issues report in September on the issues involved with the RPMs and consider, and we know there are going to be many suggestions for changing them in various ways, whether that process should be the informal process used for the new TLDs of implementation teams, or whether now that we've had the experience, the new program is several years old and legacy TLDs are involved as well, whether any changes in those RPMs are going to require a formal PDP, since the registries affected by any changes will be go beyond the new TLD program. Thank you, and this council can consider that question as we're over the coming months and then, once we receive the issues report. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Next, I have Stephanie and Mariela. You added yourself to the queue after I could drew a line on it, so if you could be brief after that.
Thank you, Stephanie Perrin, for the record. This is a naive question. I'm learning as I hear all these interventions, but I'm puzzled. If we accept that the contract is basically a policy instrument that has been agreed through various PDPs, what goes into it, that I'm puzzled as to how ICANN staff and the other contracting party can then basically pick from a smorgasbord or buffet of possible things to put in the contract. The proposal was made that, does GNSO want to review contracts? And I would say definitely not. But surely GNSO does want to know that the contracts are following set protocols for certain types of registries, registered contracted parties. And I'm puzzled as to why a multi-stakeholder organization would forget that there are other stakeholders that might have a view as to what's being included once the two parties get together, because there are other parties here that have an interest in what goes into that contract. Phil mentioned a moment ago that he couldn't think of an example. Well, I can think of plenty of examples in the data protection and human rights area where ICANN has not set policy, but the contracting party might decide to do something that we would have a determined view on. And so I think it's inappropriate, and I'm obviously not surprised, because I'm never surprised when I find something that hasn't been particularly harmonized. I think my version of harmonized is different than Marilyn's version. But it does seem to me that there should be limits as to how much freewheeling goes on in this contracting business once the PDPs have set certain things in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephanie. Marilla?
Thank you, Volker, for your flexibility for allowing me to speak. I'll be brief. I think that there is a reason why things are done through the PDP, and one of them is to listen to the community and to assess the consequences of what we are doing. And I don't think that we have assessed the consequences enough to unilaterally enforce URS at this point. And many comments have been raised and good points in the discussion. So I would ask us to take a step back on this decision. From a governance standpoint, I think that is very important to agree and respect what has been agreed and also what has not been agreed yet, and this is something that we have not agreed upon yet. And continuing on the idea that Greg has raised on respecting and remaining faithful to what we believe is good policies and not picking and choosing the policies that we prefer, I would like to ask you a question, maybe not to answer now, but to include in your following report. What is the part of the JAS report that has been implemented, and what are the concrete measures that you are taking to facilitate applications for the new GTLDs from the developing regions of the world? Thank you.
Which JAS report?
The report that has been produced some years ago with measures to facilitate the application for new GTLDs from developing regions and underserved regions of the world. I did not hear something about this, so maybe if you could include in your next presentation would be nice. Thank you.
Thank you. I think this is an entirely new topic that I think should be worth discussing, and if you want to come back to the community on that, maybe in writing in some form or shape or at the next meeting, that would be perfect. I think we heard a very spirited discussion, heard a lot of different viewpoints. One position I did not yet hear, and that is that of the registrant. I mean, it is one thing to have a policy implemented and imposed on TLDs that have not yet launched. However, ICANN taking a position, and even if it's just suggesting that you would like or prefer a registry to adopt a certain policy or a certain mechanism that is not yet a policy, impacts the registrant in an existing TLD, impacts the registrants in that existing TLD. And I would ask or suggest that I can take that into consideration when making such a suggestion, because of course the registry is free to adopt it and suggest it yourself, but I can take a position towards that, I think, is the wrong approach. I can should always look at all the parties involved, all the interests involved, and the registrants that have a domain name that are suddenly find themselves on a new regime because ICANN has taken a position or ICANN has suggested that it might be wise for the registry operator to adopt a certain mechanism might not be the right approach. If you have any last comments, I would like to yield the floor to you.
Other than I have to run to another meeting, but I appreciate actually all the different opinions that were presented. I think that I want to make sure that everybody knows that ICANN is always complying and making sure that the PDP process is followed. And we make sure that whatever we put in the new contracts when they are negotiated complies with the PDP process. I never suggested that we should implement new policies in the contract. To the contrary, I think that there is some confusion in the discussions that's been happening between the fact that a registry puts something in the contract versus it doesn't does not necessarily mean it cannot do these things outside of the ICANN contract. So the URS was implemented by CCTLDs. They don't have a contract with ICANN. A registry could actually implement registration policies that will actually affect the registrant in certain ways and agree on implementations with their, you know, with the registrars that are not in the registry agreement, and they still, you know, could have the similar effect to having it in the registry agreement. So it's not all in one place and that's the place where everybody should focus on having everything. And the other point is that there are a lot of things in the contract that don't fall under the PDP process. So, you know, there's the contract is many pages, and the area that is a PDP area is defined and well thought out by the community, and so there are a lot of things that get negotiated in the contract outside of these areas as well. So I hope that clarifies that we're talking about a lot of issues here and not just one, and I hope that we can get to a consensus on that, and we would be more than happy to support the consensus and implement it. Thank you.
Thank you, Akram. I think we had a good discussion here, a good meeting, and I must apologize for imposing on your time more than was originally foreseen. Thank you for your time, and I would like to ask Theresa to come forward, and then we can move on to the next topic. And without further discussion, I would suggest, in the interest of time, we move right ahead to the next topic. I would like to welcome Theresa Swinehart and Margie to the front of the table, who are giving us going. Could I have some silence, please? Excuse me.
It's okay. They don't want to listen. That's
Okay, again, welcome Theresa and Margie to the front of the table. You're going to give us a general update on the activities of the Strategic Initiatives Department, and I'm looking forward to hearing your update. So who's going to start?
I'm going to start.
Okay. Theresa, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you. And I always look forward to coming to this session because, first of all, it's sort of the kickoff. What? No, actually, I really do, Steve. I know you don't believe me, but I do. Let me share with you a couple of reasons why. We come to these meetings, and then we immediately end up going immediately into our different areas of work. And this session actually is an opportunity to talk about some of the bigger picture issues and how the different pieces are working together. And frankly, also to share a little bit about all the work that the Strategic Initiatives Department does. We have an amazing team, and you interact with different parts of our team on a regular basis. And as a department, we also work closely together internally and externally. And so it's a nice opportunity to share that. So it's a good refreshing break. So with that, let me go to the next slide here. Or do I have slide control? How does this work? Ah, Lars does. Okay. Thank you, Lars. So as I mentioned, the department actually covers a wide range of areas that many of you have interfaces with. The first is we're overseeing the management on the internal side of our facilitation of the IANA stewardship transition. And I suppose most of you are aware that that's happening and it's absorbing a lot of your time and energy, and I'll touch on that very briefly. We also conduct and handle the reviews under the affirmation of commitment. We also handle the organizational reviews and the processes around those and working with the community. Who is in consumer trust review update, which Margie's going to be providing. And then we'll go into some questions and answers. So I'll be quite quick on all of this. Next slide. Next one. There we go. So I had several slides on the IANA transition originally, but I think everybody is probably aware of it. And if not aware of it, actively involved in it. I know several of the leaderships are sitting here and see your names on regular calls. Just two steps back, it's been a little bit over a year, and I just want to comment, it's remarkable how the community is working and the enormous amount of time of volunteer hours that's gone into this, the dedication. I see Thomas here and others, Avery, you know, Steve, everybody in the room, Greg. Everybody has expended a huge amount of time, and I think it's a demonstration of not only the commitment to getting this right, I know from a staff side, and I won't speak on behalf of the board, but also a partnership. We're all in this together. We're all in this together to lend each other's expertise and each other's ideas and views, and coming up with something that's going to be long-term workable and sustainable, and that comes from a community process. Has been just remarkable to be a part of from my part, and I know for many others. So I want to acknowledge that and say, you know, a bit over a year ago, where were we and where are we today with the consolidation of the proposals and the directions that they're going. So a huge thank you to the community, and I know to a lot of people in this room on all the work that's going into that. I think it goes without saying that the naming community proposal is going through the discussions within the chartering organizations. The accountability process is also having their discussions. They had a meeting on Friday, starting to come up with different approaches and views to accommodate the public comment input on that, and we'll certainly look forward to seeing the progression of those discussions as well. The current anticipation, given the timelines that we've seen from the different community groups, is that it may be feasible by the October timeframe to have proposals that are submitted to the ICAM board. That obviously is very pending on the community work and how the work progresses. So we'll be happy to support and facilitate, obviously, the discussions in order to help achieve the timeline that the community is striving for. I'm happy to answer any other questions on that as we get into the questions and answers, but otherwise I won't delve too deeply on this. If you have any questions on details, also the colleagues in the room can help answer that. Next slide, please. So let me talk a little bit about the reviews with regards to the affirmation of commitments. Let me touch off first that there's going to be, as you know, We have a public comment period out right now on the proposed schedule and process and operational improvements around the review schedules themselves. This was in part for several reasons. One is that this year in particular, there's been the consolidation of several reviews that their timing just happened to coalesce in getting triggered by this year. And also an opportunity to work with the community on are there areas on the scheduling and thoughts by the community on how adjustments might be made on that, retaining accountability, obviously, and commitments that we have under the current structures and systems. And are there any other areas around process improvements that could be considered around this? So I'd encourage you to look at the posting, provide comments into that. I realize that, you know, we have a lot of other things going on, but this is a really important part of the organization overall. And it's an opportunity to do this. We are very cognizant, though, that while we have commitments currently under our existing structure and our existing system with regards to both the affirmation of commitment reviews and the organizational reviews that are in the bylaws, that the accountability process is also looking at some suggestions and ideas around the affirmation of commitment reviews. And so anything that comes out of that process will obviously need to be factored in to any input we get here. So I just want to flag that we're very cognizant about the different moving parts and awaiting the input with regards to that. On what's coming up, the who is two, and if you have any detailed questions, Margie here can also help answer that. Looking at assembling a team and looking at starting around the 30th of September for a call for volunteers. SSR2, likewise, plan is to start a call for volunteers around the 30th September date under the current timeline that is committed to in our existing system. Now, if the review schedule and process of improvements identifies community input that suggests altering that, then obviously that will be taken into consideration and accommodated for. Competition, consumer choice, and consumer trust, likewise, is looking at a start for a call for volunteers 30th September. So that's the current aspect. Again, look at the session that's coming up on Wednesday and also look at the comments and the public comment process on the review schedule and process improvements. Next slide. Here's what's going on with regards to the past reviews overall. I won't drill down in this. I think the slides will be made available to you. We have on the website a matrix and a progression of where we are with what's been completed, what's in progress, and the status updates on the implementation of the past reviews in order to ensure that there's transparency and demonstration of progress around those different areas of work and make it easier for the community to see what the progression is around the implementation of those areas. Next slide, please. Let me just touch briefly on the organizational reviews. Again, these are the bylaw mandated reviews on the organization itself, the respective SO and ACs. I think, as everybody is aware here, the GNSO2 is in process. The at-large 2, likewise in process, but a proposed slower schedule. And the NOMCOM to SSAC and RSAC are being currently proposed to be deferred until FY 2017, with the planning proposed to be started in 2016. You'll see down there the website with regards to the AOC reviews and organizational review information, but also, again, to flag the session on Wednesday with regards to both of these for a more in-depth discussion around those. Next slide. This turns over to Margie.
Hi, it's Margie Myalam, and I believe you have already had discussions on the expert working group yesterday in the council, correct, on what's going on. I'll just briefly touch base where we are. Obviously, there was a final report from the expert working group that came up with a proposed model. The next steps are that the board worked with the GNSO Council to come up with a framework on how to start a PDP process. We're currently in the process of finalizing the staff issue report that will be released after Buenos Aires. And as part of the resolution that accepted that framework, The board is forming a working group to oversee two aspects of who is. The first being being able to liaise with the GNSO on the PDP for the expert working group related issues, and whether there should be a next generation system to replace WHOIS. So that's one of the mandates. The second mandate is to take a look at the remaining recommendations from the WHOIS review team, the first WHOIS review team, to ensure that they are completed in a timely manner, and to prepare for the next WHOIS review team, which, as Teresa noted, would be starting under the current schedule later this year. And one of the things I want to highlight for this group is, as you think about that review schedule that Teresa talked about, it's going to involve a tremendous amount of resources, both on the staff side and on the community side, to be able to provide input and really help shape where the review teams end up with respect to the recommendations. And one of the concerns we have as staff is really the community bandwidth, whether there's enough time and resources available for everyone to handle all of those issues, because just the expert working group and PDP alone is going to be a very, very significant project with all of the issues that are associated with that. Next slide, please. The other thing I wanted to talk about, and I believe Karen Lentz already gave you a briefing on the GDD side of things, is that our team oversees the conduct of the affirmation of commitments reviews, and the consumer choice competition and trust review is also slated to start later in the year. One of the things we want to highlight is, again, that this particular one, if you look at the topics, it's very intensive. And a very wide scope of issues. This review team will be looking at consumer choice issues, competition issues such as pricing, and that's why there's a lot of survey and metric work being conducted right now. And it is also going to look at issues related to abuse and safeguards. So the rights protection mechanisms, for example, those are the types of things that would be addressed in this review team. And so as we think about getting ready to do the call for volunteers, it's a process to identify how that team is going to be selected. The AOC calls for the GAC chair and the ICANN CEO to essentially come up with the membership of that team, taking a look at representatives from the different SOs and ACs, as well as independent experts, because in particular in this area, I imagine there will be a need for experts, for example, in the competition area and consumer protection area. And so those are the kinds of things we're thinking about as we prepare for the next review. And then as I mentioned, and Karen mentioned, there's a lot of review related work going on, and there will be a session on Monday that talks more in depth about the different reviews that are being conducted by the GDD team, and the question as to how they relate to this particular review will be an interesting one for the community to consider. And next slide, please. So I think that's it.
Great. So anything we can...
Thank you, Teresa and Margie, for that update. I'm sure there must be some questions. Nothing? Is there anything that you would like to elaborate more on? Or,
Well, nobody else is going to ask questions, I will. James Gannon. So one of the things you talked about was the number of reviews that are coming along over the next, say, 5 years, let's call it. And this is something that I'd talked about with some of the colleagues before, is that particularly for some of the smaller groups, there's going to be a huge amount of pressure for volunteers and for internal resource management and everything else. So I'm a project manager by trade, and my question would be, has there been any consideration given to possibly employing the services of a program manager? So one level above project, to look at the interrelation between the various groups that are going to be participating, looking at overlap, burnout, resource management, everything, over the next kind of say 3 to 5 years, in order to be able to bring together a cohesive plan analytically rather than kind of opinion based. you know, the fact of, okay, we need X amount of people, they're going to come from this pool of talent within the organization and within the community, and how are we going to manage that going forward?
No, I think that's a very it's a very important point, and it's also part of why we put this out for public comment to begin further thinking around that and ensure that there's community input and suggestions and views. But I would really encourage, if you have ideas and other experiences or best practices, and specifically suggestions in the context of that, really put that in there, because that really allows for a full-fledged community discussion around the next steps.
I see that we have a queue forming after all, starting with Steve, then Brett, Avery, and Steve.
Thanks. Steve Del Bianco with the Business Constituency. Oh, Steve Metallitz, you met. Thank you. All right, so Steve Del Bianco, too many Steves. The CCWG proposal calls for bringing the affirmation reviews into the bylaws, and along the way we made several tweaks to it, one of which could inform the planning we're doing this fall, and that is that the review team members, once they're brought together, and we don't try to prescribe exactly how many, it's just that every ACNSO has to be represented. The idea being you might want several from GNSO, given that it's heavily related to the GNSO structure. But we said that the review team itself ought to have the role of asking for and selecting outside experts, as opposed to staff and management pre-selecting them and putting them into the team. And given the kind of pushback we've had on top-down imposition like that, I'd ask you to consider how we introduce independent experts, how and when they're introduced into the process. And we could do that now rather than waiting for the bylaws change to be adopted, because the changes I spoke of were widely embraced in the public comments that we've received so far.
And Steve, if I can comment, in past experience, for example, I think ATRT2, the chair, when he or she gets selected, typically gets involved in helping identify who the experts are to come in. So it actually has been something that's happened after the fact, not pre.
Thank you, Steve. Brett was next.
Thank you, Teresa. One of the things that we're doing here in Buenos Aires this week is looking at possible policy development processes on new GTLDs for subsequent rounds. And I'm trying to take account of, you know, what's in the critical path. One of the inputs that we want into that process is the outcome of the AOC reviews. So I'm looking at the chart that you've got out for public comment right now, and it looks to me that the three AOC reviews will complete by the end of Q2 2017. Will that include all of the work that the AOCs are doing on the previous round of new GTLDs?
And I can answer that. That's an estimate. Every group is different. Ideally, we like the work to get done in a year. But a lot of this is also something that the chair of that particular review team might be able to work out as they develop a work plan, for example. I mean, part of what we're trying to do in the reviews area is to have more of a program management approach to things, where you deal with certain issues, you know, where you plan out your work, in other words, to be able to get it done at a certain time. And so that might be something that the chair of the group might be able to consider, how fast they will work on some issues that relate to the new GTLD program. But those are all estimates.
One follow-up question. Which of the three AOC reviews are going to focus on new GTLD issues? Is it just the CCT, or are there others that look at those questions raised in the AOC?
Primarily the CCT one, yes.
Thank you. Next was Avery.
Thank you. Avery Doria speaking. I wanted to ask questions on the ATRT. And the ATRT 3, which I think by schedule would be starting next year. One of the recommendations made in ATRT 2 is that because of the amount of time it takes to do that, it be ready to start like in January. as opposed to March, April, May, which is what happens if we don't start thinking about it until then. So I'm just wondering, since it hadn't been on the slides, it brought that up. So I just wanted to ask, you know, are we planning to, we had sort of set the idea that people would start in the last couple months of the year, and I understand that with the accountability process, things may change, so I don't know how that all changes, but so I'm curious about that. The second part of that question is, ATRT2 also recommended that on a yearly basis, there would be an accountability and transparency annual report, whether it was part of the regular annual report or it was basically answering all the accountability issues. Now, I don't believe that has happened in 14. I'm wondering if it's part of the 15 plans for annual report that we start seeing that. And I was just curious whether you all knew that. Thanks.
I need to look. I need to go back and check to get the right answer for the last one. But I will flag that and come back on that one. On the ATRT3, you raise a very good point, and I think we need to look at that and come back to the community with regards to that. Sorry, Sam. Yes, Sam may have the answer for the other one. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks. This is Sam Eisner from ICANN. Avery, to your question about the annual reporting, ICANN is in the process of finalizing its annual report for 2014. And so you will see in there for the first time, it's albeit a small section, but there is a section now on transparency reporting, and it will be built out as we go. We identified whatever few metrics we could to put in this year to at least start the process and start putting it into our standard operating procedures, but you will see it built into the ICANN annual report on a going forward basis.
Thanks, Sam. Thank you.
And the final question comes from Steve Metallitz. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Steve Metallitz from the Intellectual Property Constituency. Just two brief comments, both having to do with AOC reviews. First, I just want to reemphasize, as we've done frequently in this forum and with the board and everywhere else, that it's critical that representation on these reviews, in particular the CCT review, but not limited to that, devolve to the constituency level and not to the stakeholder group level. In the case of our stakeholder group, which is extremely diverse and very much affected by the outcome of these reviews. So I just wanted to emphasize that. Second, I thought one thing that was very positive in the document that's out for public comment was to give prospective AOC review team participants a realistic idea of how long they were signing up for. And I did see in there that the expectation was spelled out that the team would not, after it reported, would remain active in the implementation phase. And I thought I saw a chart there that indicated that people should be prepared to sign up if they want to be on the review team for 3 years. And I just wanted to clarify if that is in fact the expectation. That's obviously going to limit your pool somewhat. It is important to give people a realistic idea up front, but I am kind of concerned that as we encourage people to step forward and be on these review teams, are we asking them to devote 3 years to this?
Fortunately, we have Larissa here who has the expert answer on that.
Larissa Gernick. What's out for public comment is the idea that the term of the review teams would be reconstituted in such a way that the review team would still be intact through the implementation planning phase. So typically the final report is issued, the board has up to 6 months to act on that, and then it moves into implementation. So the idea would be to for the team to stay active in some shape or form until the implementation planning begins, and the purpose for that is to provide clarification and really have more of a role in engaging with staff and other community members that are doing the implementation planning. So it would not be through the entire 3-year period. It would just be through the initial few months leading into the implementation planning phase.
Thank
Thank you. Seeing that there's no further question, I would like to thank Theresa and Margie for being here. Would you like to have any last words summarizing?
I think as you can see, we cover a lot of different areas. Thank you for the input here. This is really very, very helpful. And also thank you for your continued dedication on all these different issues. I realize that with the transition there's a lot, but we have a lot of other work to do as an organization that I know that all of you are very involved with and dedicated to. So just a huge thank you. I know it's been a lot over the past couple of months, so thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I consider ourselves well and thoroughly updated.
Excellent.
And you will have noticed that Jonathan has rejoined us now, and I would like to, before I yield the floor back to him for the next session, I would have a small clerical announcement that Glenn asked me to pass along. There is a coat check at the Sheraton right across from the Golden Horn Room for people coming from other hotels with their coats to hang. Coat check is from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. That's all week, Glenn? That's all week. So please make use of that if you would like to get rid of your coats for a while. And with that, I'll yield to Jonathan. Please stop the recording on this session and inform us when we can restart.
Okay, I see Falk has taken over on my special microphone here. Are we good to go with the next session? Okay, so thanks everyone. If I could call your attention for the next session. Here we have I think there might be an open mic. If you could just check, there's no red light in front of you or on any mics. So here we have an update from the IANA Stewardship Transition Coordination Group, or ICG. We have with us Alyssa and Patrick, is Mohammed here as well, or chair and vice chair of the group? And I think we also may have with us one or more. James is as a counselor is a representative on the ICG. Is John Nevitt or Wolf Ulrich also here? Great, hi John, and Wolf Ulrich also here. Okay, so these are GNSO representatives to the ICG. So let me hand over directly to you, Alyssa, for an update, and then we'll deal with any Q&A or input on that.
Great. Thank you, Jonathan. Thanks for having us. We'll just give a very brief update on the status of the ICG's work and also what we accomplished in our two-day face-to-face meeting that occurred Thursday and Friday last week, and then happy to take questions and have discussion. So next slide, please. So as you all know, the ICG is not in the business of writing any proposal text itself, but has rather sought for the communities to come up with transition proposals for each of the IANA functions. Earlier this year, in January, we received two of those proposals out of three from the Number Resources community and from the Protocol Parameters community. In our process that we've defined, once we receive an individual proposal from any community, we first conduct an assessment just of that component. We look at that proposal, and then we wanted to look at all the proposals together. So what we did back in February was we did that those two assessment steps for the numbers and the protocol parameters proposals. And what we're doing now is waiting for the names community proposal, which, as you know, is under consideration by the SOs and ACs this week. Next slide, please. So if we look at the overall ICG timeline, and I apologize, I know the lettering is a little bit tiny. here we are in the third week of June right now, and we are hopeful that we will receive the CWG proposal very soon, perhaps the end of this week or sometime soon thereafter. Once we have that proposal, we need to do, again, an individual assessment of it within the ICG. Then we need to look at the three components that we've received together and make a determination about whether they are truly compatible, whether there are any gaps, inconsistencies, whether they are really workable together from an operational standpoint, and whether they together create sufficient accountability mechanisms for the IANA functions. So that is the process that will be taking place for much of July, assuming everything goes to plan. And in terms of what we accomplished at our face-to-face meeting, one of several of the important milestones from that meeting last week were that we established a list of volunteers within the ICG membership who will be conducting each of those assessments, both the individual assessment, and actually they have committed to do a pre-assessment, so they're able to start assessing the names proposal, even though we haven't formally received it just yet from the CWG. And then we also have a group of folks who have volunteered their time to do the combined assessment of all three proposals. And we have a conference call set up on July 8 when we will be discussing the individual assessment, and then again on July 15 when we will be discussing the combined assessment. So we have a lot of work to do and to complete in that July timeframe. If we discover that there are substantive issues that we think might require clarification or even modification of any of the proposal components, those need to get sent back to the communities. Again, as the ICG, we will not be making the modifications ourselves, but we might identify areas where we think further review or clarification is needed. And so that's what you see in the timeline several weeks in July allocated in the event that we need to send anything back to the communities. We hope that we won't have to do that, because as the ICG members across all of our different constituencies, we've been trying to keep track of each of the different community processes and determine along the way if they create any inconsistencies or other issues. But it's possible that we might have questions to send back to the communities, and so we've reserved some time for the communities to be able to do that. What we're aiming to do is, by the end of July or the beginning of August, have a complete transition proposal ready to put out for public comment and for a full public comment period for essentially the month of August, maybe a little bit longer. And so in that regard, we also, one of our other milestones from our face-to-face meeting last week was that we have assembled, again, a subgroup of volunteers who are developing the introductory text and the executive summary that the ICG intends to include in the complete transition proposal. So assuming that all of that gets done, we will put out a transition proposal for public comment, and that public comment period will take place August into the beginning of September. If we can look at the next slide. Once the public comment period completes, or actually even before it completes, we'll start doing analysis of the public comments received, much like the kinds of analyses that have gone on in the CWG group and in the CCWG accountability group. Depending on the results of that analysis, we may again have time where we need to go back to the operational communities with questions for clarification or for modification or review. And so we again have a number of weeks allocated for those communities to do that work, hopefully on short order if necessary. And then in the last phase here, we will be essentially just preparing the proposal to be finalized, any last items that may come out of that operational community work to be finalized, and we are aiming to send the proposal to the ICANN board in the time frame of ICANN 54 in Dublin. And what our agreement is with the ICANN board is that they will send on the proposal unmodified to NTIA. So if the ICANN board has opinions or other commentary that they want to share with NTIA, they will be doing that in a separate cover letter and not modifying the transition proposal itself. So that is the rough plan as we have it right now. Go to the next slide. You might note that this is an optimistic timeline. It's very aggressive. That's the way that we like to do things in the ICG. But knowing that this is an optimistic timeline, it's important to take note of the fact that any of this may be extended if it seems, or if we come to the point where we realize we need additional time for more of the communities to do work, if we need additional time as the ICG to analyze the public comments that we receive, or if it turns out that we need an additional public comment period. So there are ways in which this timeline may extend, but we are hoping to try and achieve this milestone and have the proposal finalized by the ICANN meeting in Dublin. Next slide, please. I just wanted to make note, because I know it's of high interest to folks in this room who are considering the CWG NAMES proposal this week. One of the other outcomes of the ICG face-to-face meeting is that we decided as a group that once the CCWG Workstream 1 output has been sent to the SOs and ACs for approval, and that's estimated to be just prior to the next ICANN meeting, the ICG will seek confirmation from the CWG that the CCWG's work meets the CWG's requirements. So this is essentially that final check, acknowledging that there's conditionality between the CWG proposal and the work of the CCWG. We as the ICG want to make sure that once the CCWG's work has been finalized and sent off to the SOs and ACs, that it actually meets all of the requirements that it currently exist in the NAMES proposal that we will have given consideration already. And so we have committed to do that final check to make sure that we are confident in the transition proposal that we're sending on to NTIA and that the community is as well, and the NAMES community in particular, because it's the NAMES community's proposal. Next slide, please. And just one last note in terms of what we've been doing as a coordination body. In February, we had asked the numbers and the protocol parameters communities to clarify that their proposals are compatible with regards to the handling of the IANA trademark and the IANA.org domain name. It wasn't obvious to us whether the proposals actually were compatible in this regard. The IETF proposal for the protocol parameters is essentially silent on this matter. And the numbers proposal has some specific requirements related to the trademark and the domain name. So we wanted to ensure that those are compatible. And the responses that we got from those two communities were in the affirmative that they are compatible. There is text in an annex to the CWG proposal, which is not really part of the proposal itself, but is sort of attached for the community's information, which discusses, again, the trademark does not discuss the domain name. And one of the other outcomes of our face-to-face meeting that we had last week was to request from the CWG a resolution to what appears to be an incompatibility between that text and the use of the way the mark is used by the other communities and the way it's discussed in their proposals. And so we have issued that request on Friday to the CWG and are hoping to have a resolution for that by July 2nd. In the event that this coordination between the communities requires some further work or consensus building in any of the operational communities, we wanted to make sure that we have the month of July to work that out if necessary. So that's the other substantive outcome from our face-to-face meeting last week. And I think that is all that I had. Yeah. So thanks. Happy to take questions.
Thanks, Alyssa. And before we take questions, does Patrick, is there anything you would like to add, or do any of the GNSO reps on the ICG, any comments or supplementary points any of you would like to add? Okay, well, thanks. That's a pretty good clear picture of where you are and where you in the latest update. Are there any questions or comments or points anyone would like to raise? Any issues of concern? We, of course, have a session dedicated to the work of the CWG later. Steve.
Thanks, Steve Del Bianco. Jonathan, if you were to present to Alyssa and Patrick the draft resolution that Council's going to consider this week, is it possible that they would be able to advise or evaluate whether we've got it right with respect to the broader ICG? If you recall, we were discussing it yesterday, and I offered you a friendly amendment to clarify.
I'd be more than happy to do that. I'm not sure how you'll feel about commenting on that, but for the fullness of information, we could do that. Any thoughts as to the usefulness of that or not?
So that's an interesting question, actually, because we, I think, have been pretty insistent the entire time that the ICG's relationships that are of import are with the three operational communities. And so for the names, that would be with the CWG. So I think what matters from our perspective is if, in the end, the CWG says, yes, we are ready to go forward with this. ICG, here you go. Here's our proposal. And so in some sense, I think what matters is how the CWG feels about the way that the resolution is written, as opposed to how the ICG feels. That, I mean, I would be interested in your perspective, but that's my gut reaction, is that it's sort of up to the CWG membership to conclude whether what they receive from the SOs and ACs means that they're done.
Paul Jekfeldstrom, for the record. I think what is important is to identify in a constructive way at this point in time what kind of clarifications and potential conditionalities are needed in each one of these proposals. For example, if we take this trademark issue that that Alyssa just talked about, that is to be resolved where it is discovered that, yes, the text is different, but in reality there was no incompatibility between, for example, two of the operational communities. So because of that, I think, from ICG, we encourage, first of all, cooperation as much as possible between the various groups to identify these kind of issues as early as possible. And if it is the case that something that could be viewed as incompatibilities is identified, that is pointed out in as constructive way as possible also, and okay, so what to do about it? And I think that is sort of the only recommendation that we can give.
So I could just read you the one line. It's not about integration. What the council's considering is a strong statement with respect to the stewardship part. And it simply says, there's an assumption here that the proposal would be implemented before the transition, or if not implemented beforehand, that there would be irrevocable commitments of implementation, that it would be complete within a reasonable time period after the transition, but not to exceed 1 year. So it's about assuring that the proposals are implemented, as opposed to whether the interior of the proposals are consistent.
Nope. Go ahead, Patrick.
Thank you. I was a little bit too fast there. I think a discussion that has come up multiple times the last couple of days is the definition of the word implementation. So I think where you might get questions back has to do with how you interpret that word and what that actually means. Because for example, for the transition itself, one way of looking at implementation is that the current contract that exists between ICANN and NTIA exists 1 minute and the next minute it does not. Is that the implementation? Then you have, within each one of the operational communities, you have a number of things that must happen for a complete transition, which includes like many, many, many steps that doesn't happen only in 1 minute. For all of those things that has to happen, we have to remember that some of those might involve things that ICANN has to do. And some of those things are things that we would like ICANN to do before the actual contract with NTIA has terminated. Those things either are then violating that contract, requires modification of the contract, or is conditional of the contract. So that needs to be sort of taken into account. The second thing is that I understand, not being from the jurisdiction of the U.S., that there are certain discussions regarding the difference between implementation of bylaws and adoption of bylaws, which seems to be something that might have big impact on the timeline. So my personal reaction on this text is that I think you might get follow-up questions on the word of the use of the word implementation, but if, as long as you can respond to that, I think, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I would also say again that the from the ICG perspective, our remit is somewhat limited. We need to deliver a transition proposal. And so what happens after that, including many of the implementation steps, we will certainly, of course, be in favor of getting the thing implemented once it's delivered, but it's not really within our purview to do much. I mean, the communities need to do the implementation, right? So I think, you know, we can be supportive of getting the implementation done and getting it done quickly and so forth, but as the ICG, we won't necessarily have a role in doing that. It's, you know, the people who need to write the contracts and stand up the new entities and sign the SLAs and all of that, right? So that's a broader community effort.
Okay, thanks. I think it does. It highlights a point for me to think about, which we need to think about, is ensuring that, to the extent that we can, from a CWG perspective, any approvals by the chartering organisations of the proposal are sort of self-consistent. That there's a compatibility across those. And I mean, I touched on this in the meeting. The CWG co-chairs meeting with the GAC this morning, but I think it's something we need to think about just in informal conversations between the chartering organizations to make sure that any approvals are not in any sense in conflict or that they are self-consistent at least. Donna, your hand's been up.
Thanks, Jonathan. Donna Austin. So, Alyssa, given the narrow remit of the ICG, I'm just curious about what the purpose or intent of the public comment is. So, what do you hope to?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, obviously, we acknowledge that all of the components of the proposal will have been out for public comment, some of them multiple times, and will have received a tremendous amount of review from all interested parties. The aspects that will perhaps not have received as much review are the very ones that the ICG will be assessing itself beforehand, namely, do the components fit together? Are they compatible? Are they workable? You know, is this a plan that can be implemented by the folks who work for IANA, for ICANN, and can they be operationalized? And does the proposal as a whole meet the NTIA criteria? We've been doing that analysis on the individual components, but it's extremely important that we as the ICG build a public record that demonstrates that the proposal exceeds those criteria with flying colors. And that will be very important for the success of the proposal overall in the end and getting it implemented and getting it through the U.S. government review process. So that's where we would really like to focus the public's attention for the public comment period. We are developing a series of questions that will be put out to the public with the proposal to try and obtain that focus. Of course, people will be free to comment on whichever aspects they want, but that's really what we're looking for.
Thank you, Alyssa. I think this brings the session to a close. Thank you for being available and asking questions. Do you have any points that you would just like to make in closing? Or seeing that there's no further question, I would like to thank you all. And I would like to ask to stop the recording. And Jonathan will be back in a second to start the recording again. So we'll have a brief break. Enjoy.